Well, that's not going to make the edited version, but anybody who gets to see the live tape gets to hear that.
And welcome back to another episode of Exposing Ourselves. I'm Travis Ritchie, and this is episode 76. This is the show where we expose each other to new things. Matt, a big music fan, will assign me one of his favorite music artists to listen to each week, and I, a movie buff, will give him one of my favorite films, and we come together on this podcast to discuss it all. And with me, as always, is my very good friend,
Matt Rundquist. Hey, Travis, how you doing? This week, I watched the 2009 movie Star Trek, and you listened to the British pop band Pulp.
Yes. Yes, indeed. You know, it's funny. I was, I think I told my roommate that I was listening to a band called Blur, but we did Blur already, didn't we?
We did Blur already, yeah.
I was messing up my four-letter British pop band names.
Same, same genre, same number of letters, but
so Pulp is what we listened to today. So that's
Pulp
great.
Is what we listened
I was about to make
today. An album called Different Class. Recommended to us by listener Curtis Friesel, but that's not important right now. Travis, how was your week?
Oh, my goodness. My week was pretty good. I didn't do anything, I don't think, terribly special, except we went back to work on The Talk and had two long days of shooting for our new cold open, which we're doing for the final season. And so that was a lot of fun. There was a horse on set and a really beautiful Corvette that they used, and I was doing a couple different things. I was running in the park, and I was being a stagehand, and I was doing a couple different things as well as my normal stand-in work. And I went on a couple hikes with Coco, which were always nice. And then I did a bunch of casting classes, mm-hmm. and everything I've booked except for Sugar. Community, Pretty Little Liars, The Event, all that was from casting directors that I met at classes, which are essentially networking things, right? And so you pay for a class, but you go to a networking thing. Now, SAG-AFTRA, the SAG-AFTRA Foundation, which is not part of SAG-AFTRA officially, but it's like a little separate educational wing, where they give access to recording booths for vocals. They have a camera class. They do business of acting classes. And they also do classes with casting directors.
Oh, okay.
And so I am part of the collaborative, which does the same thing, essentially, with a membership fee and unlimited classes. And you have to audition to get in. But the SAG-AFTRA Foundation is free for any SAG member, and you can go. The tricky thing about it is that I am sometimes a little frustrated at the level of talent in those classes because there's no prerequisite for talent. All you have to do is be a SAG member, and there are a number of ways to do that. But I decided to go take some of these classes in order to recruit for the collaborative.
Oh, sure.
So so now that I'm a board member, it's one of my priorities to bring our membership up to pre-pandemic levels. Mm-hmm. And so I go to these classes and I keep an eye out for the more talented ones. Mm-hmm. And then I approach them and be like, "Hey, you should audition for the collaborative."
You're like a Svengali over here. Hey,
it's
kid,
interesting.
What do you think? Would you like to be part of my special theater group?
You said that like someone who would say, "You've got moxie."
Yeah, you got moxie, kid.
So that's not far off. And that's how I was actually recruited to the collaborative. I was at a different workshop class, and one of the members came up to me, and this beautiful British woman named Karen, and she's like, "You're very talented. You should audition for the collaborative." And I was like, "Oh, okay. Well,
oh, nice." Then. Do you use your British accent when you try to recruit people? Because I feel like that would help.
No, I don't. I use a Scottish accent.
There you go.
You should have. I don't. Boy, I was going to try to whip out an accent.
I was going
to
say,
right,
you really got yourself in deep.
I was. I went pirate right off the bat, and that is not my. That was not my intention. Yeah. Okay, so that was basically my week, and did a lot of that. A lot of work. A lot of reading scripts for my other job, and I don't think anything super special. I am, for Labor Day this weekend, so this will have happened by the time people listen to it, I'm going to a nude beach.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, should be.
Do you
fun,
have to be nude too, or do you just get to sample the wares?
I think clothing is optional, generally speaking.
Oh, nice.
So, but yeah, I maybe not know this about me, but I'm a big fan of naked, and I'm a big fan of naked outside. I grew up on a lake, and when I discovered skinny dipping in a lake when I was younger, it was just kind of magical. And I feel like, as a society, we are too prudish in regards to our bodies and sexuality. And so, I don't know, I like to be experienced.
For years and years, there was a openly nude beach. It wasn't like advertised as a nude beach, but everybody knew like this was the beach that you can go to be nude in Wisconsin, on the Wisconsin River. Yeah, there's a place called Mazamani. I'm not really sure how to say it. Mazamani. And there was a beach there that was clothing optional for decades. A couple of years ago, maybe even a little before the pandemic, the local authorities cracked down on the nude beach.
Wow.
But for a long time, you would not expect it. Here in the Northwoods of Wisconsin, they had a nude beach. So
that's too bad. Yeah. Well, this one is fairly far away. It's down by San Diego, which is a bit of a drive. And it sucks that there isn't a place you could go closer to L.A. But it's a lot of fun. There is a bunch of different places. When I was in Japan, I was a little bit surprised to see that they have the onsens where you go, and they have the separated by gender. And so on the men's side of things, there were just every like group, like there were groups of like high school kids just hanging out naked together, which I thought was extraordinary. And like, you know, dad, like there was one time I saw a dad with his dad and his son. So like three generations of guys just going and hanging out at the onsen together.
Yeah.
And,
interesting.
So, yeah,
I can't go
really
to the onsen because I have pretty notable tattoos. So.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if that's that's an issue, but I don't know if that's as much an issue as it used to be.
Oh,
I
it think, very much
I think
is.
Culture is...
It is very much a live issue. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Okay. Well, I'm sorry for that then.
That's all right.
Your week, my friend?
My week has been very good. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go too deep into it, but I went to a show this week, recorded some stuff for Tea Service. I'm hoping to have a single out by the time we play our show on October 5th. Yes, that's right. October 5th still hasn't happened, so I'm going to mention again, Tea Service is playing October 5th, along with Razor Toast, which I'm also drumming for. Come check us out if you're in the Southeast Wisconsin, Northern Illinois area, or you just like driving. Either way, October 5th, Bremen Cafe in Milwaukee.
One could fly to such an event.
Yeah, you could fly in. It's our debut show. If we ever get hyper famous, you'll want the street cred of being at our debut show. And we're I'm inviting everyone. Like, I had my annual physical this week. I invited my PA and my family physician.
That's great.
Everyone that I come across on the street, I am stopping them on the street and telling them to come to my show.
Hey, you,
it makes
stranger.
Grocery trips really long, but it's worth it because potentially as many as 7 people will show up.
You know what? That's what you got to do. You got to market yourself and
You got to promote. You got to get out there.
Yeah, you got to promote. You got to promote. That's great. That's something I'm very bad at, to be honest.
Next week is the big week for me. I think I mentioned this a couple of months ago, but on September 4th, there's a concert that I really wanted to attend. It's from a band called King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. And then I found out that another band I was wanting to play is playing on the 7th. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go to that show. And then a band that I've been waiting years for them to tour is touring on the 8th. And so I'm like, well, I guess I've got 3 shows to go to. And then another band that I have been wanting to see for years is playing on the 6th. And so I'm going to 4 concerts next week.
4 concerts in 4 days. And how
in 5
how
days?
How amazing.
4
is
concerts
it?
Oh, wow, in 5 okay. days. Yes.
I thought you said 6th, 7th, 8th,
4th, 6th, 7th, 8th.
Oh, okay. But it is fantastic that none of them conflicted with each other.
Well, there's another show on the 4th that I would like to see. Actually, there's a show on the 4th that I would like to see. And on the 6th or 7th, I can't remember if it's Friday or Saturday, one of those days, there's another Eve's former euphonium teacher is having a concert, and I was like, oh, I'd love to see this, but I'm already going to a show that night, so.
A euphonium teacher? What is that? What is a euphonium?
Oh, a euphonium, it looks like a mini tuba, so it's a valved instrument that has about the same range as a trombone, but instead of being played with a slide, it's played with keys.
Do you know what? Now that you've said that, I suddenly remember, I think in The Music Man, when I played Harold Hill, there is a euphonium in there somewhere.
It is sometimes a marching band instrument.
Something, some euphonium and big bassoon.
There you go.
Each bassoon. Wow. Double bell euphonium, is that a thing? Is that the word?
Yeah,
I don't know.
No.
Something. All right. Well, I'll go look that up at some point. So, yeah, man. I have an update, by the way. Are you done with your week? I'm sorry.
I am done with my week.
So, do you remember we were talking about live albums with The Ghost a couple of weeks ago? And I generally hated live albums, and I was like, I'm very down on live albums and live. I happened to be looking. I think last week's song or last week's band, there was a song that had a piece of a lyric that stuck in my brain. And I went down a bit of a rabbit hole, and I was like, what does this lyric remind me of? And what it reminded me of was Eric Clapton. And I think maybe a line from Layla. And so I looked up Layla by Eric Clapton, and the version of Layla that I love is the unplugged in front of a live audience version of that. And I actually do really like that performance, even though you get all the audience cheering and sound and stuff like
that.
Go. But that's an, I thought I have to tell Matthew maybe as a bit of a mea culpa.
And I think we talked about this when we did Alice in Chains Unplugged, but that is by far the most popular unplugged performance of all. That was the performance that showed the power of the format, because, of course, that version of Layla is wildly different from the original recorded version from the late 60s.
Yeah.
And, of course, they sold millions and millions and millions of those records. I believe it is the second best-selling live album of all time after, Peter Frampton. Which was this weird album that came out in the 70s that everybody had to have. And, of course, nowadays nobody thinks about Peter Frampton at all. But anyways, it's neither here nor there. Eric Clapton Unplugged, world-changing. All right, Travis, we should get into it. We should get into the meat.
Get to the meat.
Let's switch things up this week. No, shake things up. I'm sorry.
Yep.
Let's shake things up this week and do the music first.
Okay, great. Well, tell me about, Pulp. I was going to say Blur again.
Oh, Pulp. Yes. Pulp is a band that's very similar to Blur. They are actually a little bit, though. There's a real class consciousness about the music that they make. I gave you their breakthrough in the United States. It's called Different Class. And it has, it's their fifth album. So they had been going along in the 80s and early 90s for quite some time before this album broke through, but it has a wildly popular single on it called Common People, and they're from Bristol, which is sort of a working class area of England, and Jarvis Cocker is the lead singer of Pulp and primary songwriter, and he has he's very in tune with the common people of England, right? The sort of the underclass of English society. And that's who he identifies with. And that's what a lot of the music is about. The other thing that a lot of the music is about is sex. This is a very horny album.
It is.
Yeah. So we'll talk about all that as we go on. But Pulp has sort of been on and off over the years. They're not officially broken up or anything. But Jarvis Cocker actually became a pretty popular BBC TV host, and he's sort of like a, I don't know, man about town a lot of the time, and so he's busy a lot. I don't know that we're gonna get any more Pulp albums, but I'm curious what you thought of this one, Travis.
Well, Matt, I had a ton of thoughts about this. I think I ended up listening to this album three times through. So it is something that I enjoyed for the most part. The horniness that you spoke of is actually very straight male horniness.
Yes.
In a way that, like, I suppose much rock is and much pop, but in definite contrast to the kind of horniness you get from like Madonna or a lot of the younger up and comers that we're seeing today. Some of that was a little bit interesting, the lyrics, and I guess I wasn't going to say it first, but since you brought it up, there were elements of like infidelity, like he was helping a woman cheat on her husband, mm-hmm. at least once, mm-hmm. and maybe a couple of times in this album. Yeah. And so I clocked that a little bit, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what Matthew thinks about that. Here's one of the things I loved about this album. Every song is different. There is a ton of variety in the music that they play. There's variety in pace, in kind of the story, and also very good storytelling in this album.
Very good storytelling. Common People, the most popular track off of here, is the one where the storytelling is strongest, which is not something that you always get, right? But one's really got a beginning, a middle, and an end.
It really does, and it's easy to follow, but you also have decent poetry, which we've talked about a lot. You know, when you're writing lyrics, this has a nice kind of middle ground between being poetic but being understandable. And so I enjoyed that. Common People is a really fun song, and it's catchy, and it is like it's got a lot of energy. I'm wondering, this last time I listened through it, I had this thing again, wondering why I didn't like it even more. And I do think that maybe I just am not into this type of music, this band, the Blur, the Pulp,
were other... actually pretty high on Blur, which is why I had high hopes for this. I think you've put your finger on something when you say this is all different, right? We call this genre Britpop, but there's a lot of different sounds here. Like, Britpop is more of a orientation, a way of seeing the world, than an actual sound, right? Yeah, like, sure, there's going to be some jangly guitars, and there's going to be a really unique vocalist. Not necessarily a strong vocalist, but like Jarvis Cocker, you know exactly who's talking right away.
Yes.
He does a lot of sing-speaking. He's very kind of lounge lizard-y a lot of the time. You know, he's delivering these you know, witticisms, or almost half-witticisms. He's a very unique dude, right? But he's not like a great singer.
But he's also not bad. He's maybe a little pitchy, but not a bad singer at all. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You know, I feel like I'm kind of on his level.
Oh,
like,
interesting.
I could probably sing about the same level as him.
If you ever find yourself in a karaoke bar with a bunch of guys from England who are right around our age, this is your song. Common People by Pulp. Because I love the song, and I sang it once for karaoke, and I got like no reaction whatsoever. And then I went to my local English pub, and the owner of the pub had a bunch of his friends in from England at the time. So there were probably 12 guys who all were huge Pulp fans, and I sang this song, and I brought the house down. There were like chairs flying through the air. It was amazing, right? It was one of those great karaoke moments when the song and the singer and the audience are all like in sync. And so anyways, yeah, if you find, like, if you have like a rugby team is visiting LA or something like that, this is the song. I'm telling you, man, they'll go wild.
All right, good. I will keep that. I will bear that in mind. But I want to make it clear, I didn't dislike this album at all. I even didn't, I don't know how to say this. I even didn't mind and maybe even liked some of the sing-talking. And you know how we talked on the Ghost album about how he has that, you really liked that song where he has that kind of like talking that he does with the audience, and and he, this album, he does a little bit of the same thing, but I think it's a much more interesting, the things he's saying. I also think it is also leading into, like, the song has a lot of singing with breaks of talking, and the talking leads into the singing in an organic way, and but also the song has a lot of energy to it. So I think all of those things together made for something that was compelling and different to listen to. So I enjoyed that.
Well, were there any other songs that stood out for you besides Common People?
A bunch of them did, actually, and it's but it's bits and pieces. Like there's a song called "Feeling Called Love" that it stood out maybe not a super positive way, because the thought that we all have is like, what is this? What is love? You know, what does it mean? And that's essentially what the song was. Although I did like some of the lyrics, like you know, the way he asks that question seems a little unique. And so,
it's funny because the song title is spelled out like each letter, because there's a lot of that in the song, right? And it's one of those things where you're spelling out such a long thing that you kind of lose track of what was at the beginning. But I feel like they really pull it off, you know?
Yeah, I did too. What about you? Any songs, like, if you can spark my memory, if you like favorite songs, maybe I'll connect.
Well, let's see. I did really like, I really like the songs where he talks about sex, right? Like he's like a horny dude, and he's not shy about it. And it's kind of funny, right? Like he's got a really great sense of humor. Although there is a great song about drugs too. I don't know if you listened to Sorted for Ease and Whiz at all. So that's a song about wandering around after like a rave or something, or even before, during, and after a rave, and talking about the experience not going particularly well, but at least they have drugs, right? And I just thought, I think that's really funny, right? You know, I've never spent, you know, the dawn of the day high off my kite, you know, but I think it's a funny thing to write a song about, and it's a really catchy little song, right?
Yeah. Was that the one where he's like, if you're going to put in an order, get me one because it's like 5 a.m. and I'm starting to get tired?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Something like that. I think maybe my issue with the sexuality is it was very blatant and very kind of on the nose. Yeah. And I do appreciate a sexuality in pop that is more like Queen, where it's
a little subtler.
A little subtler, a little more poetic, a little more,
Yeah, because there's like a song here called Underwear, and he's like, you know, you're standing there in your underwear, right?
Yeah, and I want to touch your breasts, there. And I want to, and the curve of your thigh, and like very like, yep, this is what a guy's thinking about. but I might have appreciated a little more nuance, maybe.
All right. Well, and then the other thing that I want to talk about, just real briefly, is that very similar to Blur, Pulp has a real class consciousness about it. So the song Common People is about a, you know, rich daddy's girl at art school that he meets, and she wants to do the things the people who aren't rich do, and he shows her around, and, you know, they have a little relationship and blah, blah, blah. But that idea that they are in, that the band and Jarvis Cocker are in sync with the common people of the world, the lower classes, is really goes through the whole thing. And so there's like this real balance, right? Because it's like very serious about, you know, class consciousness, and also boobs, you know?
And, yeah.
And they both make up the band Blur. I mean, so Pulp. It is very easy to confuse these two bands because they both have, their only vowel is a U.
Yep.
They're both Britpop. They're from the same time period. They're both four-letter words. And they share a class consciousness. So anyways.
Yeah, I don't remember, honestly, because we go through these and I tend to like absorb them in the week in order to discuss it and then kind of forget a lot of it. So I honestly don't remember Blur all that much. And so I'm curious how my rating, I feel like I liked Pulp better, but I wonder if my rating is going to bear that out.
Interesting. Well, if you can remember where the spreadsheet is, you can look it up for yourself, but I happen to know what it is. Travis, are you ready to rate this?
I guess.
All right, let's hear it.
Yes, I am. Oh my gosh. I lied. I'm not ready. I am.
Is there anything I can do to help you get ready? Do you need a little massage? Do you need like a pizza delivery?
We don't have time for either of those things. Would love to. Here's the thing. There is so much to like about this. The energy of the album, so many boxes that I normally like to tick. Like you can understand the words. The instrumentation seems really talented. Like these guys that are in this band are not just playing. They're really creating something with their instruments. So I think I'm talking myself up to an 8 for this. The tricky thing is here, I don't know if I'm ever really going to listen to it again. But
maybe when Curtis comes over.
Possibly. Maybe Curtis and I will listen to it while we're writing. But I think for now, an 8 is probably a pretty fair rating on this one.
Well, Travis, do you want to know what you gave Blur?
Yeah.
You gave it a 7. So okay. You were right. Your feeling
was good.
Correct. I think this is also an 8 for me. I really like this a lot. I have always been on the Blur side of the Blur pulp divide. But this really surprised me a little bit. Listening to it to get ready for the podcast, and then after assigning it to you, I listened to it a few more times, and I really dig this. And obviously, the song Common People is really one of my favorite songs. Like, I love that song. And this album largely backs that up, so...
It is a very good song. I just got this flash of an idea for a sketch where, like, this group of Blur fans is meeting up a group of Pulp fans, and they're going to rumble, but, like, some of them realize they didn't remember which band they were a fan of.
Oh, that's good. I like that. The reveal at the end is that then a bunch of Oasis fans show up, and both the Blur and Pulp fans beat up the Oasis fans.
There you go. They can all agree on that.
Yeah, that's great. All agree that the Oasis fans are the worst.
Oasis came to mind actually this week because I was talking, I think, about it with my roommate. They did Wonderwall, right?
They did Wonderwall.
Okay, so that is perhaps the only song of theirs that I know. I listened to their next biggest song just to see if I'd ever heard it. Completely had never heard it ever
before.
Well,
and they're in the news for everyone this week because they've announced a reunion tour, which everyone thinks is not going to go well because Oasis is two brothers. It's Noel and Liam Gallagher, and they were at serious creative loggerheads for several years before they broke up. And I think liquor bottles might have been thrown at some point. Like, it was a very acrimonious ending to Oasis, and now they're getting back together and on tour. And the bookies are like giving odds for if they'll actually make it to the first concert and will they break up while they're on tour and all that. So. Should be fun.
Yeah, it should be interesting. Great. Well, that takes care of Pulp then.
Sure.
We're all pulped out.
Well, Travis, tell me about Star Trek.
So Star Trek from 2009 is a...
Now, is this an existing creative property or is this original?
Yeah, it was existing. So Star Trek, of course, the franchise has been around since 1966. And at this point, there were several series. We'd had Star Trek, Star Trek The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Star Trek.
I think Enterprise had also come out by this
Enterprise,
point.
Thank you. That's the one I was thinking of. And then also several movies. So we had the original cast do 6 movies and then pass it on to the Next Generation cast for 3 movies. And then kind of nothing, and then Star Trek a little bit died, and then In 2009, J.J. Abrams, an up-and-coming, you know, young director, he had done a bunch of TV, and he wanted to get into doing more movies, and he famously loved Star Wars, but didn't think he had a shot at ever getting to direct Star Wars, so he was given the reins to direct a Star Trek reboot. And I think this is a fascinating movie to watch. I remember the joy I felt watching it. So here's the thing. Star Trek, I feel, is amazing science fiction, but the movies are never the best example of good sci-fi. The movies are really good examples of action movies. They try to make action-y sci-fi. And this movie is very action-y sci-fi, but there is also a lot of character work being done, and they also manage in a very clever way to tie it, even though it's a whole new young cast, they tie it into the original Star Trek universe. So it's not a reboot that is detached from the things that we as Star Trek fans loved. It's part of it, and I really appreciated that, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So a huge all-star cast. You've got Chris Pine as Kirk, Zoe Saldana as Uhura, Zachary Quinto as Spock. You've got John Cho as Sulu, Anton Yelchin as Chekhov, and who am I missing? Bones was he's the guy who's in the lead of
He is. He's the boy.
The boys right now. He's the boys, yeah. And also, Scotty was from Hot Fuzz and I can't remember. Simon Pegg, who I love. So yeah. Just a crazy big cast in this movie. And and it was, I thought, a huge success. And it spawned two more sequels after that that I thought kind of like dipped in quality a bit. But, you know, this movie, I think, was a really good example of a great reboot. So, Matt, what did you think, I'm curious, of Star Trek 2009?
I think I want to rate this, or not rate it, but I think I want to think about this, yes, in terms of Star Trek movies. You know, they kind of exist in their own little world. And you're right, they have to be a very different thing and do a different job than Star Trek TV shows. And I think this movie does all of that stuff reasonably well. I'm not as big of a fan of what they're doing in the movies as what they're doing in the TV show.
Yeah, me too.
But I liked this. I didn't love it. What did I like? I liked the recasting of the roles. It was, I think, interesting to me to tie it back into the original Star Trek, you know, like recasting Kirk and Spock and Uhuru and everyone else, and keeping those relationships largely the same. There is this weird air of, like, you know how one of the things that they do in a lot of the Star Wars movies now is they'll be like, oh, here's this, or especially in the Star Wars TV shows, they're like, hey, here's this thing you remember from the movie, and look at this, right? And there's just, like, you're supposed to get a, like, little moment of recognition, and then there's no, like, actual story being told. And that, and I guess, you know, we've talked about referential cinema in the superhero land, right, where I'm thinking of the movie Free Guy, where there was the fight scene at the end where they just like, well, we own all these properties, so let's get these things into the fight. And like, there's some, I don't know that I want that. I don't know that I want Star Trek to be that, right? And there's a little bit of that here. But they also are telling new stories with these characters. You know, Uhuru and Spock have a thing going on. There's various other differences, right? They're not just being like, here's this clever, like, I would say probably the worst instinct there is when Kirk sleeps with a green-skinned woman in Academy, right? Like, he very famously, I think it was the first interracial kiss. Am I right about
that? No, the first interracial kiss was actually him and Uhura.
Okay. Well, anyways, but he very famously romances a green-skinned woman in the original series. And throwing right. that into this felt very like, do you get it? Do you get it? Do you get the...
Really? I don't think they put a lantern on it. I think it was just there.
No, they didn't put a lantern on it, but it just... I don't know. It just didn't... It felt pointless except for, you know, some people are going to remember that he slept with a green-skinned woman.
Yeah, but if you didn't know, I think here's the thing. If you didn't know that that was part of the original series, that would have just been a moment that didn't mean anything. But if you did know, I think it added that little tingle of remember.
Yeah, I think I have a lower tolerance for that. I feel like I'm being played, right? A little bit.
Interesting.
Like, you know what it reminds me of? And this might get you on my side, actually. It reminds me a little bit of bands going, hey there, Los Angeles! And then everybody cheering, right? That I feel is the green-skinned woman is like, how you doing tonight, Los Angeles, of this type of movie.
Interesting.
Yeah, that analogy
Interesting.
Works.
I recently had a much worse example of that in the Alien movie, Alien Romulus, that for me sets like the bar on those references so low mm-hmm. that something like this is practically practically meaningless.
That's fair. That's fair. Anyways,
So I should
get into the actual movie a little bit. I will say the movie and the plot here did not do much for me at all because I'm officially sick of Star Trek doing alternate timelines and time travel narratives. Like when it happened in Undiscovered Country and they saved the whales by jumping forward in time or backward in time or whatever, that was great, right? But I'm officially like I want the Star Trek writers to come up with some other answer than it's a different timeline and we jump back in time and we jump forward in time or whatever. It's actually why, like, I enjoyed some of Discovery, but ultimately I was so sick of, like, all the time travel and alternate timeline stuff that it eats its own tail eventually if you don't really have a plan for it. And obviously with a TV show, you can't really have a plan for it. Here, it's not so bad, but I'm just like I love Leonard Nimoy. Everybody loves Leonard Nimoy. It was nice to get to see him. But it also did feel like kind of self-indulgent to be like, hey, it's the original Spock, and here he is. And he, you know, is saving the timeline through jumping back in time and... I can't possibly see my original self. It would be too dangerous. Actually, it's fine. I'm going to just see my original self anyways. It's cool. Right? Like, you know, because we have to hand off the baton or whatever. I didn't like that. So...
Well, ooh, okay.
Yeah, so plot-wise, this is kind of a nothing for me. But all the action is really good. There's not, like, parts of... You know, I don't like action where a bunch of stuff happens and you can't tell what's happening. And there's just like cameras and all the action is really well plotted out. And you get it. The bad guy, I think, is really good, if maybe a little generic, but he's good, you know, and he's
played
well
by acted. Eric Bana, by the way, another big name that was just.
Can I be honest?
Movie.
If you held a gun to my head, I couldn't tell you what Eric Bana looks like. Like if you gave me five. Right. And I know that he was in The Hulk and I know that he's a good actor. Like I'm not making any comment whatsoever. He's just one of those like Hollywood guys who looks like a Hollywood guy to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
And so like if you put I wish I could come up with several other Hollywood guy names right now and I can't.
Well, there's one right now that I keep on talking about. He's in the new Twisters movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That
yeah,
guy.
Every time and, I see like, him, I think he's a different guy, and I'm like, no, wait, he's not that guy. He's a different one.
Yeah, the thing I heard once for him was that he was what ChatGPT would give you if you asked for a Hollywood actor.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It's funny. Has he hosted like a Survivor or something like that? He looks like he has hosted a reality TV show.
I think big breakout was in Top Gun Maverick last year or the year before,
which I also didn't see. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Anyways, let's talk a little bit more about the cast because there were some really good casting decisions here. I liked John Cho as Sulu. I loved Chekhov. I loved giving him the heavy Russian accent you know, which doesn't, again, make a whole lot of sense, but it didn't make sense in the 60s, and it certainly doesn't make sense now, but we're going to roll with it.
Well, it made sense in the 60s because we were in the Cold War with Russia, and the idea
He was explicitly choosing someone to...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I get that. But, you know, we have universal translators, and they're in our ears, and so it's weird that they would preserve that. But anyways, I think, you know, you were going through the cast, and you were like, this is a big cast, and you were talking about people. Honestly, I think Zoe Saldana, at the time of this movie, might have been the biggest star, right? Like, a lot of these people have gone on to, like, Carl Urban is obviously a huge actor right now.
Carl Urban, thank you. Yeah.
But at the time of the movie, he was, I wouldn't say he was unknown, but he was, I mean, he was certainly unknown to me. Right.
Yeah, Carl Urban, I think, was coming off a whole lot at the time.
The other candidate I have for biggest actor at the time is maybe Simon Pegg from, you know, because those were pretty big movies.
He was, yeah. And Bruce Greenwood certainly had a huge career. He played the Captain Pike role.
Who was that?
Bruce Greenwood, he played Captain Pike, the captain who brings Kirk.
Yeah,
onto the
he's
ship.
Kind of a TV guy, right?
Isn't he
on like one of the CSIs or something like that?
Boy, I don't know. I don't think so.
Oh, he looks like a grizzled veteran on CSI.
He certainly does.
If he hasn't already been cast in that role, he should be immediately.
Yeah. But also Winona Ryder showed up in a little bit of a cameo
as Spock's
mom.
Yeah, that's right. That was good.
That was good. So I want to talk a little bit about, you went over a whole bunch of stuff, and I want to
it's great. Word vomited there.
I loved hearing it, but I want to talk about the action, and I liked how, I agree with you that the action was followable in this, even though this was probably the movie that really introduced the shaky camera, thing, the aesthetic that, that we are seeing a lot of now, and also the famous J.J. Abrams lens flares, right, which are everywhere in this movie, almost too much.
No, not almost too much. That is a completely unnecessary almost right there. It is too much. It's too much.
Some of those lens flares are unmotivated by the lighting of the situation.
Yeah.
Whatever. You kind of deal with it and you get over it. But I was a little bit surprised to see how well the action was followable in this movie, despite all that. I really like, for me as a Star Trek fan, as a lifelong Star Trek fan, I went to this movie originally worried about the rebootiness of it, right? Mm-hmm. And like, we're just going to reboot it. And I loved that they created I didn't feel like Leonard Nimoy's Spock's character was gratuitous. I thought it was integral, and they created a story in which he accidentally goes back in time after doing this thing that ends up creating this new timeline, in which, by the way, also Chris Hemsworth, who went on to play Thor, is Kirk's dad. I think it was his film premiere, actually, maybe. But, and so I thought that then we create this new timeline, and the fact that these characters end up together on this ship again felt to me like it was a fate thing, like the universe needs this to happen. And it made it feel to me much more poignant, actually, that they all ended up being together, even though some of the methods of that were a bit contrived. Like, Kirk went from cadet to captain in a week, like in a couple days.
Yeah, that was ridiculously contrived.
Yeah. However, and there are, don't get me wrong, there are a couple of things that piss me off about this movie. one of them is the fact that you can supposedly see a planet from another planet enough to, like, Spock's view of Vulcan as it was getting sucked into the black hole from his own little ice world.
Mm-hmm.
I hate that. I hate that that's impossible. There were a couple other things, but that one gets me. That one gets me every time I see it. Yeah. But ultimately, though, I'm able to forgive the things that I didn't like, the things that kind of, like, annoy me.
I'm just excited that you're pointing out things that you didn't like.
Yeah, it's not that I'm not a sycophant when it comes to, you know, my fandoms. I am very critical, as you well know. And so, like, you know, I'm not going to love every version of Star Trek or every version of Star Wars.
Yeah.
This movie, though, man, it hits these buttons, and it's just so full of kind of joy and, like, adrenaline and...
Yeah, I would say the pacing of this movie is really good, you know?
It certainly keeps moving, yeah.
But it's not overly rushed either is what I mean, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's times when, you know, like, if you think about... the one of the, like, Die Hard with a Vengeance, like one of the later Die Hard sequels where it's just like, and there's never any time to breathe or anything like that. There's contemplative, quiet parts of this movie too that still fit within the movie, that don't, like, stand out as like, oh, they needed 10 minutes but no budget here or anything.
Right.
Like
that. Yeah. Well, and I think Zachary Quinto's performance as Spock is a standout for showing a character who wrestles with his duality of being part human and part Vulcan, but also, like, his goal essentially as to be as Vulcan as possible is to suppress his emotions. Mm-hmm. And to see a character like that, and you see his emotions coming through, I mean, not even in the moments where he finally breaks, but, like, even before that, where he's you can see him processing. Yeah. And I thought that was really, really well done.
I got to admit, I have always thought that Star Trek kind of wrote itself into a corner with the Vulcans.
Mm.
You know, because, like, well, because we're humans telling human stories, right? And so a lot of stories revolve around emotion. But with the Vulcans, who nominally don't feel emotion, or now, no, I know. Now that we have established the lore far further, we know they're actually bubbling cauldrons of emotion, but it's all very quiet or whatever.
Well, they suppress. So the it's important to know, though, that they used to experience fiery emotions, and it almost destroyed them. And so that's why they've created this culture of control, not suppression, but control. And I think that actually is a very powerful metaphor for humanity, to be honest. And that was established long before this movie.
To me, it's like, it just feels like a story that's already told, and, like, it feels very, it doesn't allow change. Like, one of the things that, you know, we do tell stories for is to talk about change, right? The ways that people change, the way people start a story in a certain place and then they move. And just because of the Vulcan suppression of emotion thing, or however you want to phrase it, I feel like it does sort of limit the ways in which we can tell stories about them changing. That's all.
I can see that. I will say that Spock's character, and even in Next Generation, his dad, Sarek, who comes down with a disease that inhibits his ability to control his emotions, was a really powerful story. And so Spock's arc through the whole of Star Trek, from his original series all through this movie, is really fantastic. And I do think, again, I also let go of Star Trek Discovery in the, like, third season. I do think there's a whole thing about the Vulcans completely kind of letting go of that in the future. And so they're, but I don't hold me to that. I might be wrong.
Anyway, well, I won't.
I get what you're saying. And I think especially in the television format that we're talking about, it really lends itself to much more metaphorical looks at humanity, like using Vulcans as a metaphor, works much better than in the movie format, where you're like, why doesn't he experience? Why does he have to suppress his emotions? You don't get that explanation here, which I can see how it'd be frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know that I have much else to say. I think I've said my big pieces here. Do you have anything else you want to add?
No, man. I'm ready to rate.
All right. Give it a rating. Lay it on me.
I think you're probably going to be a little disappointed with this, but I think this is a 6 for me. It's above average. I thought about giving it a 7, but that just doesn't feel right. Like, I enjoyed this. It was all right. But there were enough problems with it that I didn't love it. So it's a 6 for me.
All righty. Do you have, I'm just curious before I give my rating, do you have a Star Trek movie that you have loved?
Yes.
Better?
I love Search for Spock. I love The Wrath of Khan. I love, I think it's called Undiscovered Country, the whale one. I don't know.
That's Voyage Home. You said that earlier.
Yeah. I love Voyage
Undiscovered
Home.
Country is
and
the sixth
I'm,
one.
I'm actually a reasonable fan of all of the Next Generation movies. Now, I haven't seen any of them in 20 years, right?
Yeah.
But people really said a lot of bad things about the Next Generation movies when they came out, but I don't know. I like them. I don't think they're terrible.
I think to me the Next Generation movies get progressively worse as they went on. I used to love the Borg one the most because it also was very actiony, but
that's
now that
Nemesis,
I've watched them
right?
more. No, that Nemesis was the last one, was the Romulan clone of Picard. The Borg one was First Contact. Mm. But the Generations is the first one, and I have come to appreciate that one a lot, mainly for the cinematography and the acting that you get from the likes of Patrick Stewart in that one. But okay, great. So just curious. I am going to rate Star Trek 2009 by J.J. Abrams a 9. It is not a perfect movie. Wow. But I really enjoy rewatching it every single time. And there are a couple of quips that I have, middling quips, I just you didn't have to do the thing with, you could have given him a telescope to be watching Vulcan with instead of seeing him with his naked eye. Like, the planet is bigger than our moon in the sky, and that's not right.
Yeah, that's not right.
Anyway, that's about it. So great. What have you got for me for next week?
Next week for you, have you ever heard of the band Foster the People?
I don't think so.
Have you ever heard the song Pumped Up Kicks?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, all you little kids with your Pumped Up Kicks.
Yeah, Foster the People is the band that made Pumped Up Kicks, and they came out with a new album this year that I think you might really like. And so I have listened to it a bunch since it came out. It came out I think a month ago, right? It's called Paradise State of Mind, and it's really, really good. It's kind of upbeat, dancey, funky music that we haven't had a whole lot of that type of thing on the podcast, and I'm interested to see if this is your jam. So your assignment for next week is indie pop band Foster the People's new album, Paradise State of Mind. What do you have for me?
Well, we're going to go from action to drama, and we're going to do a Best Picture winner that I don't think you've seen. Have you ever seen the movie Birdman?
Birdman, I have not.
Yeah, okay, great. So Birdman came to us in 2014. It's a kind of a dark comedy drama. It's by a director by the name of Alejandro Iñárritu, Alejandro González Iñárritu, And it stars Michael Keaton as
Iñárritu.
And it stars Michael Keaton as a washed-up actor who is best known for a superhero that he once played called Birdman. And so it's a little meta in that regard because, you know, casting Michael Keaton of all people. And it kind of follows him through the movie. It's a supporting cast includes Emma Stone and his daughter as his daughter, and I think this was her first Oscar win.
Okay.
But it also has got Zach Galifianakis, Edward Norton, Amy Ryan, who I love, and Naomi Watts. And I'm interested to see what you think of this. I think there is The big thing about this movie, I think, at the time, was there was a lot of press about how it was filmed to appear as one continuous shot.
Mm.
And so that's something I would like you to kind of keep an eye on. And yeah, so I'm interested to revisit this. I think I've only seen it once when it was doing its screener run. So I saw it probably 10 years ago almost. And I'm interested to see it see it again.
Yeah, this is a good pick this week, Travis, because this is definitely a movie that was on my radar as something I wanted to see but have never pulled the trigger on. So this is exciting for me.
Well, it's also interesting because, of course, now we've got another a sequel to Beetlejuice coming out with Michael Keaton. Did I say that right? Michael Keaton?
Yes, you did.
Boy, suddenly my brain just tweaked.
Yes, Michael Keaton.
So, of course, we've got another sequel to Beetlejuice coming out with him, and so it's a little bit timely in that regard as well.
Awesome. Well, Travis, you know, I wish that more people would participate in the conversation. I wish that our listeners would write in to us and tell us things. How can they do that?
Oh, it's so easy. All you have to do is shoot off an email to exposingourselvespodcast@gmail.com. And that's a good way to let us know if you have favorite albums that we should listen to or favorite movies that we should watch, and or if you completely agree or disagree with our stance on the things we do watch. There's another way, too, if you want to go to our Facebook page, which is just search for Exposing Ourselves, and you'll find us there. And you can very easily message us or send us a or comment on our posts there and let us know what you think of our various choices.
Awesome. And you know what, people, if you did enjoy the experience of listening to the podcast, go to your podcast player, scroll all the way to the bottom, give us a rating. It helps us get exposed to more people.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Matt?
Yes?
Thank you for exposing yourself to me.
Well, thank you for exposing yourself to me, Travis.
My pleasure.